There's not one single theory. If you take all the, if you take everything as a fact as you look at it, there's not one single thing that stands up on its own. There really isn't.
It's mystifying.
This is back in 1959 when anything was possible. Thing is, Tim, it comes back to this business of somebody, you know, a committee sitting down and saying, how complicated can we make this story? He said to his wife later, if anything happens to me, look after our son. I think he probably guessed there and then what was happening, that it was the scene was being set. And, you know, there's lots of small things, you know, like I say, they shouldn't even have been on that mountain, so why were they there?
And now, ladies and gentlemen, Banal of America Audio, with your host, Tim Banal.
What is going on, my friends? This is Tim Banal of banalofamerica.com with another edition of BOA Audio Season 9. On this installment of the program, we are finally going to take a look at a case and a place that has fascinated me for quite some time, and I've really wanted to dig into it for ages here on the program, but I was always waiting for the right guest to come along and the right book to come along, and finally it's all come together here on this edition of BOA Audio. Of course, I am talking about the infamous Dyatlov Pass incident, and helping us to delve into this mystifying case is our guest, Keith McCloskey, author of the book Mountain of the Dead, The Dyatlov Pass Incident. Over the course of the next 2 hours, we are going to look at this truly puzzling story from top to bottom and all points in between. We're going to dig into all the different angles surrounding the Dyatlov Pass mystery. We're going to look at all the various theories. We're going to look at all the various players involved. We're going to look at all of the information that we have on what went down in the mountains of Russia in 1959, and what we really know, what's speculation, and what might be fabrication. We're going to do all that over the course of the next 2 hours, so you don't want to hear me talking much more. But I'm going to give you a little behind-the-scenes look at why I'm talking to you right now, and that is because when I sat down to edit the interview, I was completely distraught to realize that the first 4 minutes or so of the program had just this butchered audio, this absolutely unlistenable audio. Thankfully, it was only the first 4 minutes. The rest of the program is pretty much smooth sailing. So I decided to sit down here tonight, tape a new introduction, cut out my lengthy introduction from when I first sat down to talk to Keith. So hopefully that cuts out a large portion of the difficult audio, because I knew if I just posted the show as I originally wanted to before I discovered all these problems, people would have listened to it and been aghast and shut the program off after about a minute of this really atrocious audio. So I wanted to kind of ease people into this, let you know. I'm going to roll right in now to me asking for the bio background on Keith McCloskey. We'll get that from him. Very bad audio on that, I apologize. But then, shortly thereafter, about a minute or so, you'll hear it roll over into the clean audio. And then everything, as I said, from there on out is pretty much smooth sailing. So, with all that said, and without any further ado, here's my conversation with Keith McCloskey, author of Mountain of the Dead, The Dyatlov Pass Incident.
Welcome to BOA Audio. I'm really looking forward to digging into this just absolutely fascinating case.
Thank you very much, Tim. I'm pleased to be here.
You know, generally we start out on the program here with the bio, the background. Tell folks about who Keith McCloskey is and how did you end up, you know, on the path to that long path, if you will.
I've always had a great interest in mysteries, and I've also been quite a student, if you like, of Soviet military history, and that's how I came across the story originally. It's such an amazing mystery, really. It really grabbed my attention.
I don't know if we'll ever get to the bottom of it, to be honest.
It's intriguing stuff, like you were saying. The slippery sort of pincer, like you said. Right when you get your hands on it, one way you think you kind of got it, and then it slips out of your hands, because another thing comes up, and you have to try and figure it all out all over.
For me, anyway, I think it's important to keep an open mind on this. In the book, you'll read a chapter called Yuri Yakovlev.
He came up with what I thought was, you know, quite a plausible sort of explanation, but I got a lot of flack for it, if you like. You know, some people said, oh, what a load of nonsense, and, you know, this is just tripe and all the rest of it. But to me, it was a first-hand account of somebody who lived in the area who tried to explain it through, if you like, you know, almost a paranormal theory. And I don't reject anything. You know, if somebody contacts me and says, well, you know, I'd like to put forward this theory, I'll listen to them. Because to me, if you say, no, this is my theory, and I'm going to make all the facts fit it, the simple truth is you can't make the facts fit it, because there's no one theory that stands up. And I think it's only through keeping an open mind on the whole thing that, you know, an answer will eventually hopefully come.
Mm. Yeah. Well, it's well, we'll sort of get towards the end of the conversation, sort of get to what possibly could ever come out now this far from the event. But to set the stage here, there's so much to dig into. There's so much to talk about. And like I said, I absolutely love the book. And the words I was trying to say really was like, you feel reading the book like you're the 11th man on the trip. You know, if you're Yudin's...
Oh, that's very kind of you. Thank you.
Oh, absolutely, man. That's how I felt.
Glad I wasn't on the trip.
yeah, exactly. You know, if you're Yudin was the lucky 10th guy to get away alive, then you're the 11th person on the trip, sort of just
yeah.
You're a part of that crew. And it's really... it's compelling stuff to the point where when they all go missing, you feel like, you know, you're worried about them, you know, you feel bad for them. It's really great stuff. So I guess we'll set the stage here. Let's talk about the expedition here. Let's talk about the players on this expedition, how it all started. So the pre-trip, the before, the set of it all up. You know, you've got 9 folks, 10 total with the guy who turns around and goes back. But this whole thing was what I thought was interesting. To sort of put this into the minds of people, we're talking late January, February 1959. So how long ago was that now? I can't do the math in my head.
Well, it should be 56 years because it's just past the anniversary of the night they died. It was just over a week ago, which is a pity we couldn't have done the interview, you know, nearer that actual date, because it would have almost been 56 years to the day.
That's true.
But as I say, unfortunately, I've been ill. But it's, you know, a lot of people might say, well, you know, what I tried to get over in the book is that this was something that young people of that time, you know, for them, that was... if you like, their way of letting off steam and enjoying themselves. You know, you might think, well, why the hell would you want to trek in 600 miles up to the north of Siberia and go into deep mountain snow and basically put your life at risk? But it was very, very, it was called ski tourism, and
right,
it was very, very popular among students and young people of the time. And obviously, you know, you needed to be very fit to be able to do it. But it was a way of, for them, of, you know, living in communist times, it was very regimented, and, you know, people basically watched you, and, you know, you had to follow the party line, literally, and for them it was a way of getting away from it all, and, you know, a group of young people together just enjoying themselves, so that's part of the reason they were doing it.
Yeah.
It was something that they were all involved in. They were all very fit. Igor Dyatlov himself, the expedition leader, had actually made a journey up there the previous year to the mountain, the original mountain they were going to, Otorten. You know, it's something that they all enjoyed, and it's something that they all did virtually every chance they got, they could go away. The ski tourism was a major part of their life.
Yeah, exactly. It's kind of like, you know, it's kind of, I liken it kind of like to a spring break here in America, but, you know, we're talking 55 years ago in Soviet Russia. This was the version they had of spring break, which is kind of to go hiking up into the mountains.
Yeah, well, funnily enough, spring break is a big thing there in the university. That's obviously after
you know, after the winter, but they have a spring week or spring break where, you know, it's a chance that they all the youth get together and they have games and, you know, athletics, I mean, and, you know, there's sports games. But that was a big thing as well. But, you know, the opportunities in the Soviet Union for, in inverted commas, trying to enjoy yourself were few and far between. And if it wasn't approved by the party, basically you didn't do it unless you wanted to run into trouble.
Yeah. Okay, so it's just so I can be sound cool to people later down the line. How exactly is it Dyatlov?
Yeah, Dyatlov.
Okay,
yeah,
I've always said Dyatlov, but all right.
Yeah.
Dyatlov.
Well, I mean, I'm learning Russian, but I'm certainly no linguistic expert on it. But I think people will understand when we say Dyatlov.
There you go. That's how we can tell if someone really knows what they're talking about.
Excuse me. Yeah.
You know what I mean? They can say, "All right, well, if they say a Dyatlov, then you know they're in the know." So Igor Dyatlov, and this is the cool part, like I said, about the book. I always thought just where they died was the place was called Dyatlov Pass, but it's actually named after him now in retrospect, because he was the leader of this expedition, Igor. And there was 10 folks, one guy had to turn back. I guess we're sort of like, we'll sort of go on the trip a little bit with them here and sort of talk about it a little bit. You know, it's supposed to be 22 days and first they have to go. It's interesting. They go, you know, to these towns on, via rail first.
Yep.
And slowly get further and further out of civilization, which I thought was really creepy and cool in a lot of ways.
Yeah. They went, they took the train north and, they went to, a city called Serov, which was their first stop. And one of the group there got into a bit of trouble because, he started singing in a railway station. He was arrested by the police, you know, for basically disturbing the peace. And a lot of people try and read something into that, but, you know, it's just small town provincial police with nothing better to do than see a bunch of strangers and try and make life a bit difficult for them. But he was released without any charge, and they carried on up to the next town. And from Ivdel, they took a bus up to a small village called Vizhai, which is now, it was a couple of years ago, it was completely burned down in one of the many forest fires they have up there. And from there, they took an open-air truck, just basically a Russian military truck, up to where they started their journey by foot, you know, to make the overland part of their trip. So it was. It took a few days to get up there, and it's the whole distance from the city up to where they were going. It's about 550 to 600 miles. So it's a good bit out.
Yeah, I mean that's. I don't think I could. I'm certain actually that I could not do this. Even travel. That's really 500 miles a long ways, folks.
The thing is, it's the last part of the journey, you know, let's face it, people talk about Siberian winds and winter, you know, it's a bit like Alaska probably, you know, at the time of the year they were doing it, when they were trudging along, as the snow got deeper and the weather got worse, you know, they were in single file and making their way through snow that was basically 2 to 3 feet deep.
Mm.
You know, and the way they do that is you have one person in front and he sort of basically beats down the snow as he goes along, he or she. Then when they're tired, they go back to the back of the line. The next person then gets the worst of it, you know, so that the person at the end of the line has got an easier path, if you like, because the eight or nine people in front of you have basically made the path for you, and that's how they'd get their rest. So, I mean, it was really hard work.
Oh, yeah. There's pictures from the expedition that were found later in the camera, I think. This, you know, the picture right before they go disappearing a couple days before is, like, treacherous. It's like, oh, my God, I don't even know, you know. It's really, it's, like I said, it's remarkable stuff that people were even doing this or even wanted to do it. So Dyatlov's, He's leading this expedition. There's eight other people. Well, 10 if you count Yuri Udin. I keep mentioning Yuri, so let's tell the story of Yuri and sort of wrap up his end of the whole story.
Well, but, I mean, he was so friendly with everybody in the group, and he was basically, he had to turn around and go home because he had pains in his legs and his back, which were aggravated, if you like, by the cold, because when they set out from the village, when they went on the truck, it was an open-air truck, and then basically it was a biting wind, and that really didn't do him any good at all. But he kept going until they got to the abandoned geologist village, because he had promised the university that he would collect a load of samples for them of the rocks up there. He felt he had a commitment to them. Yeah. He promised that he'd bring all these samples back, because he really wanted to turn around a lot sooner than that. So he stuck with it, even though he was basically in agony at the end. And after they spent the night at the abandoned geologist's village, which basically was about 20 old ramshackle huts, nothing more than that.
Right.
He spent the night there, and then the next day, that was the 28th of January, he turned around and said goodbye to everybody and then made his way back.
Now, so, just so I can kind of keep track in my mind, how long did it take from when they actually departed originally to the night of February 1st? Like, how long was that journey?
Well, they left on the 23rd of January.
Okay.
That's the date they left Sverdlovsk.
So about 10 days.
Yeah, about that, yeah. Okay. So, just coming up to a week, 10 days, I suppose, yeah.
And approximately when did they, actually, you know, probably from the journal, but when did they leave that last place that was the huts and stuff and just start out on foot?
That was the 28th of, where Yuri Udin said goodbye to them was the 28th of January.
Okay.
So taking that up to that was only just a couple of days, a few days away from that, the night that they died.
Yeah.
So really, I mean, although there was journals kept and all the rest of it, you know, there's all sorts of talk about alterations in the journals and you can't trust them and blah, blah, blah. Up to the date, the 28th of January, everything can be verified because people had seen them. Yuri Udin was with them.
Mm.
Once he said goodbye, really, nobody knows what happened. Whatever happened, happened between there and that night.
Right. Okay.
And depending which theory you want to follow, you know, before we start deviating into all the different routes, because if you say they died, you know, on the night of the 1st and the 2nd of February, you know, according to the journals, which a lot of people dispute that they're real anyway, you know, you can take that particular view. You can also take a view that something happened to them almost immediately after Yuri Udin left. It all becomes a very big gray area once he goes.
Mm, exactly. Yeah, the door is open then for anything can happen, essentially, once we meet Yuri.
Yeah.
Okay, so we've established Dyatlov. He's like this respected, he's done these trips before. He's sort of like, he's the player of the whole thing. And the other guy, I think that's, I kind of only wrote down a few of the key people, I thought, and that's, you know, obviously with all due respect to all the folks who passed away. Some of them were more players in the story, if you will.
They were, yeah.
And the one I think that we should talk about, because he comes up a lot, and that's Zolotarev.
He's
the one who a lot of folks focus on, so, and he stands out amongst the rest. So let's sort of fill in a little background on him.
Well, he's an odd character. When I say odd, he's totally different to the rest of them. It was actually the night of his 38th birthday when he died, but he's almost old enough to be the father of some of them. You know, when you think they're, you know, 20, 21, 22, 19, he's 38. You know, he's twice their age almost.
Right.
But he's, you know, he doesn't really fit into the group, if you see what I mean, from the point of view he's not from the same background. He'd fought in the Second World War, you know, on the Eastern Front, you know, which was pretty hellish fighting,
right,
you know, against the Nazis. And he had, he'd reached the rank of sergeant, and he had medals, decorations for close combat fighting, which if you can earn decorations for that on the Eastern Front. You're obviously something pretty special. So he was certainly no wimp or wuss. But it's odd that he's in there with them. You know, he just doesn't seem to fit in the group. And then this sort of leads on to other sort of theories, is that he was a KGB agent, and, you know, we'll discuss some of the rest of it later on. But, you know, he's such an oddity, if you like. He's more worldly wise than the rest of them. The part of the story is, so people would say, well, why was he there? You know,
right. I was just going to have that as a follow up. Yeah, just to
yeah, he was. You know, he was into ski tourism just as the rest of them were, and before he'd come over to Sverdlovsk, he'd been in the Altai Mountains. He'd been working there as a, if you like, as an instructor or, you know, a guide. And the Altai Mountains are, you know, a good 1,000 or 800 to 1,000 miles away to the east from Sverdlovsk. So you say, well, why did he bother coming back, you know, and how did he get tied up with them? But it seems apparently one of the lines of thought is that he was quite hot on one of the females. There was two females in the group,
right.
Luda and Zina, we'll call them, but both attractive girls. But Zina really was something, you know, sort of, I suppose we'd say these days, quite hot looking. And he had a, you know, the story is that he had designs on her, if you like, even though he was nearly twice her age, and that's why he tagged along. You know, whether or not you want to follow that line, I don't know, but it's one of the lines, because one of the theories is, you know, about what happened to them is there was a big punch up because she was actually going out with Igor Dyatlov, and she'd also been going out with another member of the group as well. So, you know, there's three males who are, if you like, interested.
Right, exactly, yeah. She was, I had her here as one of the major players, because she seemed like she was very, her charisma leapt off the page just from
reading. Oh, yeah, very much so, yeah. A highly intelligent girl, and, you know, the tip for great things, you know, had she lived, there was talk of her probably even making the Council of Ministers and all the rest of it. Very charismatic girl, you know, and that comes out because when they're making their way north, you know, they stop off in a couple of places, and, you know, she goes to a school and all the kids want to talk to her. You know, she sort of drew people to her, and all, obviously, as I say, plenty of male interest in her as well. So, you know, a very charismatic girl.
And like you said, there was, if not a love triangle, certainly a love quadrangle going on there.
Yeah.
There was a lot of, you know, a lot of guys, the guy-girl ratio wasn't great on this trip.
No, it wasn't.
The other woman on the trip is Luda, and I thought that she was kind of interesting in a way, because you make a point in the book, her personality is very distinct. She's very, had sort of a pro-communist, pro-motherland attitude, and was kind of interesting, especially because later on, you know, I guess no point in sort of worrying about spoilers or anything. Later on, when they find her body, she has her tongue cut out, and you mentioned in the book that she had a reputation for being sort of backtalker. You know.
Well, yeah, I mean, the story about her is that if she thought you were a fool, she'd tell you. She wasn't afraid to speak her mind, and it was Yuri Yudin himself who said that it was ironic that she was the one that had her tongue missing, and you know, it was ironic that she was the most outspoken.
Right, exactly.
And she didn't suffer idiots gladly. You know, if she thought you were a fool, she would tell you to your face that she thought you were a fool, or if you're talking nonsense.
Yeah.
And Yuri Yudin confirmed that as well. So, you know, he said that she was very, very forthright in her opinions and not really afraid of anything or anybody. So, you know, you can draw your own conclusions as to what happened to them and why her tongue was missing.
Yeah, exactly. That's what stood out to me, where it was like you said, she didn't suffer any fools, and then later on you see what becomes of her and you wonder if there's a connection. It's kind of one of the spookier parts of the story.
Yeah, yeah. And horrendous injuries as well, you know, so smashed in chest.
Yeah. That's four of the people. The other five... there's not. I don't think anything really particularly stood out except for the two guys, Alexander Kolevatov and Yuri There's a long one here. Krivonishenko.
Well, there's Doroshenko and the Krivonishenko. All highly intelligent people. One of the oddities in the rest of the group is, and this is French, Russian, is Thibault, as he's called, to make it easier, Nikolai Thibault Brignol. He was the son of a French communist, and he had been born in the camps, you know, the gulag.
Hmm.
His father was, he'd come to live in Russia, you know, he'd been a French communist, and his father obviously fell foul of the regime, if you like, as just about everybody was doing at some point, and he was executed, and he was a bit of a, again, another, I mean, he didn't necessarily stand out personality-wise, but he wasn't one who fitted in as easily as the rest of them, if you see what I mean, because he was different, you know.
Yeah.
he was basically, I suppose you could say, half French and half Russian.
Hmm.
He also had access to, you know, the Soviet Union was a difficult place to get books and magazines from outside the Soviet Union, but he was always able to get hold of them, so he had sources whereby he could get, if you like, illegal literature.
Nice.
So, the rest of them were, you know, just, I suppose, just your average Soviet student, you know,
right.
Who was intelligent enough. A couple of them were working in the nuclear industry.
That's what I was going to mention, yeah. It seems like there was sort of a slight, I think those two guys I mentioned, I may be mistaken, though, the two guys with the K, with the last names.
Yeah, Krivonishenko and Kolovatov, yeah.
They were the ones who seemed like particularly more tied in with, they were kind of moving out of the university ranks and into the government, it seemed like, or they were doing research or something like that, right?
Yeah, that's right, down at Chelyabinsk, which is, well, it still is a closed city. There's nuclear facilities there where they're working. There was a big accident in 1957 in near Chelyabinsk, a place called Kishtym, and there was quite a serious nuclear accident there, and they would have been there at the time.
Hmm.
So, you know, people read, you know, things into that because, you know, obviously there's nuclear weapons,
secrecy involved, sure.
Yeah, I mean, the stories of spies and all the rest of it being responsible, one of them was maybe meeting up with somebody to pass over nuclear material, and, you know, it's a bit of a long shot, really, to say that. I mean, I know they have that background, but they were highly intelligent people, you know, with degrees in physics and this kind of thing, and you could say, well, they would have been working there anyway, whether they went up into the mountains or not, you know, and if you're going to meet a spy, why go up into, you know, the middle of bloody nowhere and just to give them some secrets, you know, when you think a street corner might be easier.
Sounds like, yeah. Okay, so we've kind of painted the picture here a little bit about who these folks are, and tell me, I had this later in the notes, but it bears mentioning now, because, like I said, I really loved how informed the book is on these personalities and their early journey up there and stuff. So, but you were saying now that some people have, they have issues with the journal. So talk a little bit about the journal, because that provides so much information to the case.
Well, yeah, they all kept diaries, but the main journal was one which each person of the group would take turns in writing, and, you know, to say, well, you know, we're here today and all the rest of it. I mean, the last entry, and it was actually made by Igor Dyatlov on the night of the 31st of January. It wasn't written in the following day. But that was meant to, if you like, give a record of the whole trip. And the thing is, you know, it'd be the automatic place to look to see if you want to find out what happened, or what was going on, that would be the one place you'd look in to say, well, whatever happened, there might be a clue in here. But the view of Yuri Kontsevich, he's the man who keeps the memory alive. He runs the foundation, the Dyatlov Foundation in Ekaterinburg. He said that there was numerous changes and, you know, rubbings out, if you like, of the pencil in the diary that you know, he thinks the diary's been altered to fit the facts.
Hmm. Now,
and
where
he's not the only one.
Well, that's there's two. I got two questions here. First, where is the diary now? Do we know?
Well, the thing is, a lot of the material is held by the foundation. You know, so but the diary was kept by the police, from what I believe, along with the tent, because you see, the tent is something else. You know, that's, if you like, almost the main piece of evidence, and that's disappeared. Nobody knows where it is.
Interesting. But, like, let's say I won the lottery tomorrow and I had just endless, you know, endless funds, and I called you and I was like, let's go find this diary and look at it and see if we can look at what, maybe we can find something in the actual diary that maybe no one knows about. Could we even do that, or is it like so?
Not really, no. Well, you see, I've suggested, you know, there's a lot of, I mean, I'm going to come on to something in a minute that's cropped up from the latest, they've just had the latest convention.
Hmm.
But, you know, I said, well, look, why don't we just pay? You see, there's a file missing. They say that there's still a file that hasn't been released. And I said, well, surely, you know, the way things work, I'm not saying it's a corrupt country or anything, but, you know, money usually talks. And I said, well, why not say, well, to somebody who might be able to influence things, well, here's a bit of money, can you let us have a look at this? And the real feeling is that all you'll end up with is a forgery.
Oh, really?
That's what I was told.
To see the diary, though, not the file.
Yeah. I mean, you could say, well, okay, we could have it. There must be ways you can test it to test the authenticity and the age and all the rest of it. But then you see, I mean, we've got extracts of the diary. Might be able to say, well, there was a crossing out here, but who's to say they didn't cross it out? You know, that's the trouble. Everything seems to go around in circles. You can say, well, this date was changed here. You could say, well, Krivonischenko was doing the entry that day and he got the date wrong.
Huh.
You know, there's nothing in it that says that, you know, we were being stalked by a strange group. No, that's the problem, you know. And any alteration or any change, you could say, well, you know, they did it because they wanted to rewrite something else or whatever. So, you know, it may not be, the hand of the KGB or a malign influence or whatever. I mean, all the diary entries don't say much. I mean, one telling thing in the diary entry, I think it's old Krivonischenko had a hellish temper, apparently.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about that, yeah.
Yeah, well, he exploded with rage when he was asked to sleep on the floor again. He did it in the, in Ivdel. He sort of slept on the floor. And when they asked him to do it again, you know, he literally exploded with rage. It had an effect on the whole group. And the following day, there was one-line entry in the diary. You know, obviously, this, you know, if you've got one person in a group of 9 or 10 people, you know, especially with a hellish temper, it can have an effect on everybody else around them. You know,
oh,
there was just one entry that day, you know, which just sort of basically spoke about the journey, and that was it. You know, it wasn't sort of filled with, we all had a good laugh today, and somebody pushed somebody else into the snow or whatever. You know, it's almost as if you could see the subdued atmosphere coming out in the diary.
Yeah, no one wanted to listen to the mandolin that day.
No, that, well, yeah. Beautifully put. that's exactly sums it up.
Okay, so, but part of me just, I'm kind of hooked on this just a little bit, so maybe, so we don't know actually where this thing is, because I know that the smoking gun's not in it, but to me it's like an artifact of awesome importance, and it'd be really cool if it was on display somewhere that people could look at it, but it sounds like that's just not, we don't even know really where it is, it's somewhere.
No, really, no, I mean, to be honest, I'd rather see the tent.
Hmm.
I'm hoping to go back in August and do a follow-up book, and I'd love to have seen the tent, because I've been studying the picture of it, you know, where they've re-erected it after they brought it down from the mountain. And when you look at the slashes in the tent, you know, some of it it doesn't make, to me, it doesn't make sense, because there's a large square being cut. You might say, okay, well, there's a load of people, they've got to get out quickly. But if there was this blind panic, you know, I mean, put yourself in that position. There's something life-threatening. I mean, are you going to take several seconds to make sure you cut out a perfect square?
Yeah.
You know, I mean, I think if it was me and I had a sharp knife in my hand, I'd be blindly slashing at it trying to get out. But it looks to me almost as if some of the cuts are, you know, as if somebody stood there and said, all right, well, let's make out that they made their way out of the tent, you know, so they cut a careful square, you know, which isn't a complete square, so it falls down, and there's a few other cuts in it that look as if somebody's taken their time over it, you know. It doesn't look right to me, and that's the thing I'd rather look at, but again, nobody knows where that is.
Another thing that's gone missing is, it sounds like it went missing right from the get-go, and that was they kept an alternate journal of sorts, a tabloid, sort of a faux newspaper. That was sort of more of like their jokey, you know, their Charlie Hebdo.
Yeah, the old Taunton Times, yeah. I mean, that was, like, as you say, a bit of a joke, and we have a copy, you know, a copy's been made of that.
I thought that was just gone.
Yeah, well, yeah, but, I mean, we have the copy, and, you know, that there's, you can see the reference. We now know that snowmen exist, and people read, you know, things into that about a Yeti and all the rest of it, but, you know, it could be just more of a joke than anything else.
Okay, so I thought that we never knew what was in it, but we do, okay.
Oh, no, we do, yeah, okay. Yeah, we do.
All right, so we've set the stage here. We've brought everybody up to theoretically February 1st, when all hell breaks loose, and then I guess you're great in timing here with my notes, because here I have tent is slashed. Now, I wouldn't be able to tell the difference, but clearly there are experts and stuff, so they know for sure that it was slashed from the inside out and not from the outside in, right?
Well, that's what they say. How they work that out, I don't quite know.
Right, because I couldn't tell you if you showed me.
No, I couldn't either, and, I mean, it's just one of the things I'm going to be querying when I go over, but, presumably there must be a way you can tell maybe from the cutting of a knife. And I suppose if somebody was going to slash it, they'd say, well, all right, will you go in the tent now and make out as if you're slashing your way out, you know.
Right, right. Well, I guess what the thing that sticks with me is because if it was, you know, if they're certain that it was slashed from the inside out, then it eliminates a whole bunch of possibilities of someone approaching the tent or doing something, you know, like that.
Yeah.
But we never really can be sure of that. So I don't even know where to begin, because we don't really even know what happens that night. But one thing that stood out to me was that it seems like, from what we gather, from what we can understand, I guess that's probably the best way to start, really, from what we know or what we think we know happened that night, something happened. They slashed their way out of the tent. Then they traveled in a single file line, a walking pace, which this I think really stands out as a critical part of the story, because it doesn't make any sense.
No.
If they were in a mad dash to escape the tent, why then walk away from the tent without any provisions? You know, let's just start there and sort of try and unbundle this. What do you make of that?
Well, it, to me, it's a glaring discrepancy. They're walking away. I mean, okay, don't forget it's 2 to 3 feet deep of snow as well, but even so, you wouldn't expect single file either. You'd expect them to kind of spread out and run, you know. I mean, you'd see that there would be, you know, people tripping and falling over, but it seems to be a kind of an orderly descent. And it said with people with line, the odd pair of tracks coming out from the line and then coming back into it, which, again, you know, having a bit of a suspicious nature, that looks to me as if, you know, the scene is being set, and they said, okay, right, well, now you walk down to the bottom there to where the trees are, go off you go, 9 of you in a line, and just to make it look good, somebody wander out every once in a while, because if you're in a mad panic, I mean, you wouldn't even think of running as a straight line, I wouldn't have thought.
Yeah. And to try and sort of wrap my mind around this, the listener's mind around this, do we know when the tent is slashed, when the escape happens, or the attempt to escape happens, do we have any idea sort of like what time of day this may have been? Because the difference between it being at 1 in the morning and 1 in the afternoon is huge, because, you know, there's such a difference in visibility and everything. Do we have any idea, really, any speculation about maybe what time of day all this went down?
It's about two to three hours, probably 3 hours after the tent has been pitched, which is when it was getting dark. You know, we're thinking 9 o'clock in the evening, maybe 10, nighttime, when they're almost going to get ready to hunker down for the night. It's in that time frame.
All right. Okay. So we're talking.
One of the last photo, the last photo shows them pitching the tent that night, and it's you can see it's getting dark. So they pitch the tent. It takes a little while. They get into the tent. They have something to eat. And then basically they're sitting around getting ready to settle down for the night.
Okay, so I'm trying to paint the picture here, trying to put myself in this position, in this situation. And so then something, I guess if we're just going by what we know, what we think we know, and based on the official version, we'll say, you know, then something happens, they make this escape. But then what adds another layer to this story is they're found, the bodies start being found, down the line here, but the first bodies are found a mile away. So theoretically, they would have had to have left that tent in the dark and then gone a mile away.
Yeah,
which seems like that's a vast distance to go.
I mean, it is. Yeah, yeah.
So that's another part that really troubles me.
Well, you know, it is. It's a hell of a distance. Some people explain it away by the fact that they're trying to get away from what they think is an avalanche. You know, that's one of the theories. But, you know, if there's an avalanche, then why the orderly descent? You know, if you think, bloody hell, you know, there's a wall of snow going to hit me, you know, thousands of tons of it, I'd better run as fast as I can because, all right, you're going to run down the mountain, you're not going to run up it, and you're not going to run to the side, because the avalanche is going to come down after you. But it doesn't explain the orderly descent of it. I can understand that if there's an avalanche, they want to get away from the tent to the bottom of the mountain, or at least get, you know, as far away from the mountain as they can, which is why they go to the tree line. But it doesn't also explain why they stay at the tree line, because I was over in Lithuania the year before last with a mountain survival expert who, you know, we were doing the Dyatlov story for the Discovery Channel, and he said to me that he couldn't understand why they didn't go into the trees for shelter. You know, even if there was an avalanche, the trees would afford you protection from the snow that was coming. You know, there were big cedar trees.
Yeah.
So why stay where they were? It could be that they got there and thought, well, okay, there doesn't seem to be an avalanche. Maybe we'll start heading back up shortly, back up to the tent. You know, that's a possibility.
Mm. Well, that's the other part. So I'm trying to figure out, like I said, put myself in the minds of these folks and the situation they're in. Are they skilled enough where if they travel this mile away, are they skilled enough to be able to find their way back? Because the whole idea, like maybe they got lost somehow in the process of escaping from something. That's, I guess, my question here. What do you think?
Well, it's possible, but they're skilled people. But you see, one of the big mysteries of the whole thing is what they were doing there in the first place, because that wasn't on their route, that mountain.
Yes, yes.
And these are people who are supposedly highly skilled in, well, I mean, we'd call it orienteering over here, map reading. Igor Dyatlov had done the journey the year before. It was daylight, so how do you find yourself where you're not supposed to be? You know, for people who, this was the highest level of complexity, as they call it, highest level of difficulty. So how did you wander off your route when you're so near to, you know, to your home goal, if you like?
Yeah.
So that isn't explained either. But which comes into the other theories, you know, of something happening to them, but so it's not explained what they were, you know, how did they get lost in the first place. It's possible it was dark that night, the weather was bad, that, you know, maybe they had difficulty finding their way back, but you'd think they could at least maybe have followed the tracks. But bearing in mind that it was, you know, it was cloudy, there wouldn't be much light and all the rest of it. They did light a fire, so they could have had some light. But the thing is, they weren't very well dressed.
Right.
So the cold would have been attacking them, well, would have been started to attack them from the moment they left the tent.
Exactly, because this is like intense temperatures as well. Like you said, 3 feet of snow. So, I mean...
Minus 26, yeah.
Because, you know, you have to put yourself into the minds of these people if this is really happening, and it's like they seem to be acting in a lot of paradoxical ways.
Yeah.
Because even... You know, if you think you're going to have to get the hell out of there as fast as possible, like, you still put your shoes on, man. I mean, that just seems like that's just human nature. So I don't get that. That really mystifies me.
No, too. I mean, and that's a crucial point, isn't it? Because you need your shoes on in that sort of place. You know, you're risking certain death without them, which comes back to what was it that drove them out? What was so life-threatening that you're not even thinking what you're doing. You know, you're running to get away from it. Except they weren't running.
Exactly.
Somebody's put forward, there's been a couple of theories put forward, which I've got on my website, that it could have been they'd all been blinded, you know, that there's this talk of the lights in the sky. Maybe they were blinded and they had to try and get away quickly, so they tried to follow each other hand on shoulder, you know, like they used to do in the First World War. Soldiers blinded by mustard gas. That, you know, they needed to get away, but they had to do it slowly because they've been blinded. That's a possibility. But even so, you know,
put a coat on.
I think if you're in a blind panic, you know, and even if you were blind, wouldn't you just keep running? I don't know. You know, it's never having been blinded. You know, it's. And had to say a life-threatening situation.
Yeah, in a tent,
but to
yeah.
me, you just run, you know.
Yeah, yeah. It's and you know, and whatever drove these people to seem to do it universally in a sense, because it wasn't like one person forgot their shoes or whatever. They all did, you know. They all.
Yeah. Yeah.
So it's it's all very perplexing. A lot of I'm sort of picking at the things that really stood out to me. So. So to continue the narrative in a way here now, they're ostensibly a mile away. Now, I'm going to jump around here in a sense just because I'm trying to, like, put this all together from how it all might have gone down. So we know two are found at the tree. Three yep. are found crawling back to the camp.
Well, that's what it looks like. Yeah.
Right. So, but then later, the other four are found at a different location. How do we think this went down, I guess, sequentially is what I'm saying.
I mean, it's almost as if you've got four that have been, you know, seriously injured, if you like.
Mm.
Two of them very, very badly. That's Luda and Zolotarev. You know, there's broken bones and all the rest of it, and they're in a pretty bad way. So the thinking is that they had a kind of a den made for them. And then the others thought, well, maybe let's try and light a fire. That doesn't go very well, so three of them think, well, let's try and get back to the tent and get, you know, some more clothes and materials and, you know, more light and what have you,
right.
you know, stuff to try and keep them alive, and they don't make it. But the first query I have with that is, well, if you're going to do that, why make the fire so far away from the people that you're trying to, you know, if you like, with the worst injured, why not make the fire closer to them? Because it was 75 meters away, there's plenty of trees around and wood.
Hmm.
So it doesn't make sense that they're so far away from them. Why not stay closer to them?
We don't necessarily know if the final four that are brutally injured, if they were injured at the time of the escape, or if something might have happened in between, in the interim,
no.
later on down the line.
I mean... There's theories that they were injured up at the tent and, you know, that they managed to make it down to the bottom, but, you know, it's, if you like, the trouble is, you see, although it talks about the footprints that go down, once the tent was found, there was nearly 40 people converged on it immediately.
Right.
So, you know, there's one, the first guy to really start taking it apart, a guy called Kisilov, He said, well, how can you even say that they were in a straight line, the footprints, and how can you say they were walking? Because When they found the tent, don't forget, they didn't expect to find dead bodies.
Right.
They just found the tent and they thought, well, they're obviously somewhere nearby. So there wasn't that kind of imperative, if you like, to let's preserve it, you know, because something bad's happened. So we can, you know, try and work out what's happened. Everybody just started tramping all over the place. And I think a lot of what he says is pretty good because, you know, I don't think anybody took any real notice of the footsteps at first. You know, they thought, well, we found the tent, let's follow the footsteps. But almost immediately more people were arriving, you know, and coming up, and pretty soon the footsteps were all being walked over.
Right, right.
You know, and it was 2 days as well before they found the first bodies. So, technically speaking, the footsteps should have led straight to them.
Mm, that's true, yeah, and they didn't, so that's kind of a confusing part of it, too. So, we don't, yeah, exactly. A lot of this, we talk about, like, the sort of these, it's an incident sort of like a Roswell type of thing, where, you know, there's all, there's all kinds of, we don't know exactly what the hell's going on the scene of the situation when it all goes down, because it's all very, very, very muddied at this point. And like you said, the search parties arrive there, they mess it up even worse. This is 1959, folks, so this is not like CSI, like you see on TV nowadays.
Anything but.
Yeah, exactly. So, yeah, it's like the opposite. So they find two of them dead at the tree. Three are crawling back. Takes a couple of months later until they find the other four folks, and they have brutal injuries. So that's kind of the base of the whole thing. You know, no one knows why they ran out of the tent. No one knows why they tried to escape the tent or escape the scene. No one knows why they're a mile away. No one knows what injuries happened to these folks.
Yeah, or when
exactly. Yeah. But it does seem like the final four, because they had some clothes from the other three folks, from the other five folks, that it seems like they lasted a little bit longer.
Yeah.
And then they're discovered by, I guess we've taken it up to sort of what went down that night, we think. We don't know exactly, obviously, but we've sort of brought the story to there. Then it's interesting that it stands to reason, and you can't write fiction better than real life. It takes like weeks for anyone to even know that these folks are gone or anything, which makes the whole thing even sort of more tragic in a way.
Yeah, I mean, you've got to allow a bit of slack there from the point of view that
they should still be on the trip. So no,
you know, bad weather, delayed. They're all highly skilled. Blah blah blah. You know, Yuri Udin mentioned the fact that a rumor was started even before they were found that they were trying to escape to the west. But you think, well, he felt as if, you know, the characters were being blackened at the university, and a lot of people were quite angry about it. But if you're going to escape to the west, would you go up into deeper Siberia? You know, if it was me, I'd be heading, you know, south to the warm water or something,
right,
rather than into the, you know, the worst, most inhospitable conditions you can find to try and escape.
Yeah.
It didn't make a lot of sense, but, you know, there's a suggestion there that the authorities are behind these rumors. You know, in other words, the authorities already knew what happened to them.
Hmm. Well, there's a part here later on that we'll get to. I guess for now we can kind of get into the theories, right? I mean, that's just, we've set up the whole story now. And there's no shortage of theories.
No, there's not. And there's new ones coming out all the time.
Well, I guess before we dive into the theories, there's one thing I want you to talk a little bit about. And it does tie into the theories and stuff, so it's not completely off the beaten path. But I learned about these two phenomena in the book, and I've told people about them because they're just so unsettling and so creepy. Paradoxical undressing and terminal burrowing behavior. Just two creepy things that are just like, you hear about it and you go, oh, geez, gives me the shivers. So I guess talk about these two phenomena that happen to people when they're freezing to death.
Well, I mean, the paradoxical undressing has been put forward by a number of people because they were wearing different clothes, you see. For instance, you know, the two guys that were found first were almost naked, but they were found side by side, and Yuri Udin had given his shirt to one of them, but that shirt was found on Igor Dyatlov. So what it suggests is that those two died first. Of the cold, if you like. You know, they were found, there was burn marks on their hands and their feet where, you know, they were losing you know, the feeling in their limbs, basically.
Yeah.
But they reckon the paradoxical undressing is where when you're starting to freeze to death, your body tries to protect the inner organs, if you like. You know, the body, basically your heart and the vital organs,
right,
keep you alive. And it's more or less says, well, goodbye to everything else that's out there. It's trying to keep the body alive, but eventually it reaches a stage where it virtually gives up, and then the blood flows back out to the rest of the body, and the body, if you like, becomes overheated with this rush of blood going back out to all extremities again, and you get so hot people start taking their clothes off, but at this point you're also disorientated, and you're not far from death when that happens. The terminal burrowing is like when the body is in the final stages. You're actually very close to death at that point, and the cold is returning, and you're trying to actually burrow into the ground or burrow into something for warmth, and your body's actually doing it unconsciously. And there's some sort of thought that maybe this is what was happening with the four of them, you know, in the den, but... The thing is, when you look at it all, it's, you know, the two guys that were found without clothes on, people are saying, well, you know, they probably died first. They didn't have enough clothes to go around, so, you know, it's a natural enough reaction to think, well, you don't need it anymore, so I'll have it because I want to stay alive.
Right.
You know, and their bodies were laid side by side as if, you know, there was some respect for them, if you like. You know, they remove the clothes and lay them down gently side by side as a kind of, some kind of respect to the dead bodies. You know, so that the there's a kind of irrational thinking there. You know, also where the four with the worst injuries were found is almost as if they'd tried to make a den for them to keep them warm rather than, say, an attempt at the four of them terminal burrowing, you know, at the very end of their lives. It's possible, you know. Again, there's no hard and fast, you know, sort of, this is definitely what happened.
Right.
Everything's open.
Exactly, exactly. Now, diving into the theories now, I guess the mainstream, the one I heard recently, somehow I stumbled upon it, probably after reading the book, I was sort of just doing an internet dive just to read everything I could, kind of. And,
yeah.
You know, the skeptical lot, they seem to just blame it on a straight-up avalanche, which to me just doesn't really... It just seems like such a lazy way of getting out of the whole story, which doesn't really add up a lot of the issues. But we should tackle that one first, because that seems to be the most mainstream reason that people give. So what are your thoughts on the avalanche theory?
Well, I don't believe it's an avalanche. I don't think that's got anything to do with it, because apart from anything else, they were 900 feet from the top of the mountain. So you wouldn't have been able to, you know, there wouldn't have been sort of, I don't know, like they were at the foot of Everest.
Yeah.
And there was, you know, 5 miles of snow built up above them, and they were nearly at the top. With the slope where they were was a very gentle slope. It was 18 to 20 degrees, you know, and an avalanche needs to be at a much steeper angle than that before it'll move. You can actually get slabs of snow which can move, but, you know, it doesn't add up. All the tent poles were still standing, you know, if it was a genuine avalanche, and because that's one of the theories, is some of them were hit by, you know, a wall of snow, which, as I say, is extremely unlikely given the angle, you know, of the slope. But you know, you wouldn't expect tent poles to be still standing.
Mm.
If ribs were going to be crushed, then, you know, surely a tent pole isn't going to be able to withstand that kind of force. But all the poles were still standing on the tent. You know, is it possible they heard what they thought was an avalanche? You know, they were all pretty clued up. There was still a bit of light when they pitched their tent. They must have seen they weren't far from the top. You'd think they'd have used their experience to say, well, you know, we're near the top. Well, there won't be much of an avalanche. And even if they started running away from the tent, I mean, it was a mile away. You're not going to run, I don't think, anyway, for a mile. Surely at some point, if nothing's caught up with you, you think, well, I'll stop and turn around and have a look.
Yeah.
You know, well, you would, wouldn't you?
No, I was just saying that to myself. Well, yeah. Something would have to be really, really terrifying for me to run a mile.
Yeah. Well, you'd be, I mean, apart from anything, you know, you'd surely hear it.
Hmm.
You know, because an avalanche makes a rumbling noise. It comes back also, though, to this thing about, you know, everybody has their pet theory. If you talk to a mountaineer, it's an avalanche, you know, without a doubt, because, you know, with all the greatest respect to this survival guy that I was with, great bloke, you know, but his opinion is it's an avalanche and that's it, because he's actually been in an avalanche and survived it, but he said, well, I know what it's like, you know, which is fair enough, but it's not an area known for avalanches. You know, that's the other thing about it, is it's the northern Urals are not steep mountains, you know, it's not like you need, you know, sort of sheer rock faces and all this. You can walk it, as long as you're reasonably fit, you know. All right, snow is a different thing, you've got to be a lot fitter to be able to make your way through deep snow, but the actual mountains themselves are pretty gentle in mountaineering terms.
Yeah.
So it's not an area known for avalanches.
Okay. Now, this kind of just came into my head here as we were talking today. I didn't even think about it when we were reading the book, but the final, I keep calling them the final four, but the final four folks who were discovered, they had the most gruesome injuries, but also they were found a few months later. Is it possible that in the transport of these found bodies that the injuries could have occurred then to the dead bodies? Because maybe they found them a couple months later and they were like, let's get these the hell out of here. We need them quick to wherever. Or they didn't care as much because it had been 2 months, so that less care was given to the bodies and thus the injuries. Is that possible?
Well, yeah, I must admit, it's the first time I've heard that. It's certainly possible, but the thing is, the cracked ribs were in a direct, you know, on both Zolotarev and Luda, that they were in a straight line, and it's odd that both of them had exactly the same injuries. You know, I'm not discounting what you say there. She had her nose, though, had been smashed right into her face.
Mm. Well, it could be two things going on at once, in a sense. It could be, I guess what I'm thinking is maybe they just found them and they just sort of half-heartedly
I hear what you're saying there. Yeah.
You know?
It's, but then you come back to why were the four of them separate? You know, why weren't they with the rest of them? You know, it's this splitting up that doesn't really make sense.
Hmm.
But yes, yeah, no, I mean, I hear what you're saying. I mean, as I say, it might be something I'll take up when I go over. And,
yeah, you
because,
should.
I mean, there's still members of the search party left. But, I mean, you'd need to be, I don't know, for cracked ribs, I suppose, you know, their clothing on. You'd need to, two of them would have needed to have had their ribs hit whatever they hit, but they're exactly the same location, if you like, because they had a line of the crack was in a straight line as if something had hit them very hard. I mean, also, what the autopsy said about them was that they looked as if they'd been in a car accident.
Yeah.
I mean, you don't necessarily look as if you've been in a car accident just by somebody chucking you on a lorry, I wouldn't have thought, but yeah, it's certainly worth looking at.
Yeah, I mean, I'm just, like I said, it just kind of came to me as we were talking, but it's like,
yeah.
We talked about sort of the negligence of the investigation in the first place, or the lack of keeping sort of a clean crime scene, then you wonder maybe there were other mistakes that happened that were attributing to the incident itself. So,
yeah.
It's worth thinking about.
Yeah, it is.
There is only one superpower in the world, led by the greatest leader in the world, Vladimir Putin.
You're listening to Banal of America Audio.